One of the things that I've been focusing a lot on at this time is the summation of 40 years of research as it comes to a close. It's been something that really it's a once in a lifetime thing. Is scientists spend their entire lives dreaming of this moment, of that moment where you pick up a field of research and it leads to this. And it's something that I started in 1984 without realizing consciously what I was doing. By the time I was 8 and 12, I was already running data and analysis on it, learning scientific methods, studying it. And it was my schoolroom. It was how I grew up, in addition to also pursuing the questions, the answers for the questions. And it was all curiosity driven. It was, what is this? What caused the fall of the Roman Empire? Why did it go from this great, glorious thing to the Dark Ages seemingly overnight? That did not ever make any logical sense to me. What is love? What is God? Can you prove that God exists? These questions, I was 4 when I started asking the majority of these questions. And one of the things that, as I reached the end of my research, I became part of my own research. This is where the research really went into one area where I started to notice my own anomalies, notice things about myself that contradicted what everyone else was doing, which led me back to the early education I received, ancient Greek education. I picked up educational sciences in 1992, 1990. There was a horrific car accident in my family that killed 10 people. And I was, at 10 years old, subjected to death and the loss of life at a very young age. And that moment really had me step back and reflect what is important in life. But also at 10 years old, I was taken out of school and sent to stay by the bedside of my best friend at that time, who was in the car accident. And I watched my best friend go through significant brain damage, entire memory wiped for a while, inability to speak. Her entire system had been reset. So I took a massive, massive interest in brain function, brain damage, and why my favorite person in the world, my best friend at 10 years old, was suddenly having to be reset and start over. And I watched her development as she got a repeat on life at 10 years old, how her life then completely took a different logical course than where she had originally been. And I had that before and after data. So by the time I was 12, I was not only looking at the way the brain structure is and how the brain is set up, I was also analyzing my own education, because that accident led my parents to pull me out of the Christian parochial school and put me in a different educational system, the United States public school system, which was, I would later find out, Trojan and Roman based. Now, up to that point, I had been raised exclusively in my mother's genius program, which she developed completely unaware that she was developing literally a replica of ancient Greek education as well as the ancient Persian educational system, which is the same program that Jesus got when he was an infant. So by the time I was 10 years old, 11, 12, I was very concerned about my education future and what that loss of 1 year of school would do for me. I noticed that they were passing me out of grief sympathy. I noticed they were giving me a free pass. And I was, at that time of my life, very concerned about how that would impact my education. So I began the educational sciences in 1990 to 1992. And Thomas Sowell, immediately, I was able to find his work. And what I love most about Thomas Sowell is he was doing the research that I needed for my studies. So I let him do the research. Thank you, Thomas. And I was able to just read his conclusions and findings. And the most amazing thing about this is I was studying Thomas Sowell all through from 1992 all the way up to 1998 when I was in high school. So while I was also doing my own research, I was in the field living what he was talking about. I had this one teacher, an English teacher, who at that time, I watched her say to the classroom, this really stands out, you got a 60 in my class. If you promise to do better next semester, I'll give you a 95. And he said, okay. And she changed his grade right there on the spot. And I saw her do that repeatedly. Now, in the meantime, I'm at home reading Thomas Sowell, same day, and he's explaining the drop of standards of teachers and behaviors. So in 1998, I was in a college course through that class, same teacher, and she had assigned us to do a thesis. And my thesis was the decline of the American educational system with cited evidence and sources. So I was able to take Thomas Sowell's work, as well as my own personal experiences, and put that together in a thesis. Needless to say, the teacher canceled the entire thesis and gave all of us a 100, claiming that we all had accomplished the work, which was, again, another testament of the entire thesis proving my point. So by 1990 to 1992, as I started to study where education comes from, what is the history, who are qualified, who are the best teachers of the world, all these questions I was asking between 1990 and 1992, which led my research by 1992 to one very clear, solid answer: the ancient Greeks. These guys had it figured out. They had education mastered like I'd never seen ever since. These were people who cranked out genius after genius without even trying. It was extraordinary. They had figured out the genius formula, and they were just cranking out genius after genius. And when you look at the Greek history of the Roman Empire, not the Roman history of the Roman Empire, never read that crap. You want to read the Greek history of the Roman Empire. And that's exactly what I did. From 700 BCE all the way up to 100 CE, you're given a lot of ancient Greek perspective on what the Romans, who were Trojans actually, around that time period. And you get the full history of, so this is what the Trojans did. After the Trojan War, they changed their name to Roman. And it's funny because all the Greeks knew this. It was in their history books. So they were explaining that the Trojans, hellbent on vengeance after losing the Trojan War, changed their name to Roman, infiltrated, and then took over the Greek culture. So Romans, Trojans, are teaching to this day that the Roman Empire was this great thing and it rose up. But the ancient Greeks in 500 BCE, they were well aware that these guys were actually the Trojans and they were infiltrating, taking out their culture, taking out their language, deliberately altering it to take down and take over like locusts the ancient Greek culture. And they had a history of doing this. Like, this was their culture. They had a locust culture. It was fascinating. And everyone in Greece knew this. Fortunately for the Greeks, Trojans don't read books. They just burn them. That's the sad part. So they knew all of this. They knew that they could publish pretty much anything and the Trojans wouldn't read it. And they did. They knew they could tell the truth and the Trojans wouldn't touch it. They would just burn it. And they knew they had to do something, because they knew when you have X amount of mathematical knowledge with Magian that it's going to lead to X. You know this. So the Greeks are openly talking about this because they know Trojans don't read books. That's one of the best things about having a really stupid enemy who doesn't read. When you have an illiterate enemy, oh, it's great. You have a code. And that code, that secret code, is called writing. And they knew this. The ancient Greeks knew that they had a secret code called writing that the Trojans never even thought of breaking. It was wonderful, such a great advantage. So the ancient Greeks used this to their advantage. And just to make sure it was extra, extra special, you know, coded, Pythagoras, around that same time period, around 600 to 500 BCE, he created something called isosophy. Isosophy was the rough draft of what he later called gematria, which is in the Bible. And I figured this out when I was like 12 years old, 12 to 15, 1992 to 1995. And I noticed there was a code and I cracked it. But what this has really got really, really interesting is Plato also had a code. And I figured out Plato's code. And I cracked it, and I read all of the decoded everything. Like, it's all there. It's all in code. So you have first the first code, which is called writing. But the second code is Plato's code and Pythagoras's code, not the same code. And when I read the Bible, this is where things got really interesting. I'm like, whoa, there's like three books here, but you can't see the other two books. And people are focused on gematria when they're reading the Bible. And that's not right. You need to focus on isospsepe, but you also need to know Plato's code to read the Bible accurately. Now, Da Vinci figured this out. Da Vinci figured this out in the 1500s. And that's also out there. Very exciting stuff. So I was 12. It was 1992, 1995. And I'm living the Da Vinci code. The book hasn't even been written yet. It wasn't until like 2001, I think it was, is when the book was released, Da Vinci Code, Dan Brown. And when I got the book, I was like, oh, he figured out what I figured out. And it was funny for me because I was like, oh, dude, you're way off. And then there'd be other times where I'd be like, no, okay, yeah, you got that right. Oh, you're spot on with that one. But no, dude, you're way off over here. So it was amazing to see Dan Brown doing the same research I did. And I felt like I was grading his paper. That's what it really felt like. When I read the Da Vinci Code, I felt like I was grading Dan Brown's paper. I felt like, okay, I can understand what you're saying, but I see that you missed out completely on Plato's code, which is why his degrees of freedom is so far off. So it also reaffirmed that, oh, I'm not the only one saying this. It means I'm really onto something now. So that really kickstarted me and fueled me with passion because I knew I wasn't making this crap up and I wasn't imagining it because Dan Brown had the same conclusions I had, except he lacked a few of the components to make the right equation to build the right conclusions. So I'm sitting here while I'm doing all of this going, what are they trying to say? And that's what this is all about. What are they really trying to say? And all through when I got to the realization that education is abysmal, I went deep into Plato with his curriculum, and I turned down the dumb factor in my Roman education, bare minimum. I found the best teachers, the highest standard and quality of teachers in my classroom using Plato's formula. I was able to identify which teachers had quality, which ones I should learn from. And I narrowed it down to three teachers specifically, my French Spanish teacher, Mrs. Treadwell, my history teacher, Mr. Brooks, and my English teacher, Mrs. Dexter, who still makes my eye twitch with her multi-genre papers. So these three people were master educators. Like, I cannot begin to tell you. Now, in 1995, I also found myself a Juilliard graduate instructor, and I also got a Juilliard education in music as well. This is in 1995 up to 2001. So I also had that standard being like abusively drilled into me. And in addition to those four masters, I had two uncles, both of whom were master philosophers. So I also had exposure to the philosophers. So now we're up to a total of six masters. Six. Now, in addition to this, my pastor of my church at that time, he was also doctorate degree level philosopher in theology and philosophy. So I spent a lot of time in theological and philosophical debate with my pastor, as well as my two uncles, the Juilliard instructor, and these three teachers. So that's seven masters in literally 7 years. We're talking, it's a fluke that I managed to have masters, not just one, not just two, seven of them. This is while I have other teachers going, I'll give you this grade if you promise, while I'm reading Thomas Sowell's entire research and all of his books on dumbing down America. I knew not to let the United States government teach me. I gave that responsibility exclusively to Plato and only his curriculum. So I dumbed down my Roman education to bare minimum. I did just enough to qualify to, quote, U.S. standards, if you can call what they have standards. And while I was doing that, I took everything that Plato had taught me and cranked it all the way up to max. And I had my seven masters that I could get into these debates and use exploratory dialogue. So this was my education. And when I graduated high school, it was in 2001 when I had the Rorschach print perspective epiphany. This epiphany was groundbreaking. It was the very first true milestone in my life that took me from being a student to now I've entered the world of being a philosopher in training. It would be another 20 years before I even dared call myself a philosopher, despite what it says on my website. So that being said, I knew I was onto something. I still hadn't figured out the answers to these questions that I started asking when I was four, and I was still in pursuit. And it was in 2020, 2015 was really when it started. I started Dialectical Dialogues, having no idea that I had triggered the entire philosophical process that Hegel calls the outline of dialectics. No idea that I had done that. And I had started to write my memoir during a mental crisis. The mental illness in my life was through the roof. It was unprecedented. And all I wanted was to be mentally healthy at that point. In 2015 to 2020, I fought the mental health battle, and everything psychologists told me was wrong. They made me sicker. They made me terrified of my own imagination. And then in 2023, I found the algorithm of the subconscious mind, and that changed everything. That really was the grounding milestone of Eureka. I uploaded that into my head live on YouTube, and it cured my mental illness in 30 days, all of them. Within 8 months, I was completely symptom-free. And the work that unfolded from that point on was what I would later call the Human Project. And it was just absolutely astronomical. In 3 years, I was able to track and monitor the progress of my mind and watch the mathematical algorithm automate itself with my immune system. Well, it literally ran my entire system. It automatically purged all lies, corrected all of my logical fallacies, and took my miscalibration and calibrated me to the degrees of freedom and kept me on that line. It was extraordinary. It was so predictable at that point that I was able to use that predictability to track out and map a mathematical pattern that emerged. Not just one, dozens of mathematical patterns started to emerge. I was able to map and track all of the mathematical patterns, and I noticed that the patterns did not fit anything that we call mathematics today. Oh, but it did. The mathematics it matched was not algebraic equations. It was not calculus. It was not metric mathematics. But what it was biological mathematics, which is completely different from metric mathematics. When you look at the Fibonacci sequence, and when you look at the math that a cell follows during cell mitosis or cell apoptosis, that is not the same math you learn in school. Because in biology, 1 + 1 = 1. In biology, 1 + 1 = 1. That's called integrated mathematics. So when I realized this, when I studied the math in biology, and when I studied the math in quantum physics, I realized there's metric math, which is what everyone else learns, and then there's another mathematics that no one ever knows about, talks about, looks at, and that's called integrated mathematics. So I discovered this new mathematics. I put that together. I mapped it all out, and I noticed that all of my psychological physics, all of my biology, and these math patterns that were emerging matched integrated mathematics, which matched biology, which matched cell biology, which matched atom life. It matched all of it. That's when what I call the music box theorem started to emerge. I was able to track that. And there were other things that started to happen, consequences and symptoms that started to emerge that defied any explanation for anything that we have today. And I got to a point where I noticed I was biologically changing. It was extraordinary. I was terrified of losing the data. I didn't have an MRI machine. I didn't have any of the equipment I needed. So I documented as much as I possibly could during the entire process, which was fantastic because I was already used to being a science subject for my mother since 1980. So this was not new to me. I was prepared for this. I was made for this. So from 2023 and on, I realized under no circumstances could I ever stop documenting. Could I ever step away from the science? It was too important. But I ran into another problem in 2023. I was officially a scientist and a science subject. Big no-no in the science world. Absolutely big taboo. It is not possible to be a scientist and the subject of your own study because of the bias factor. Until. That's why and when I invented the Ashavana scientific method. The Ashwathana scientific method is brutal. It is 4 times more complex and strict than traditional scientific method. It is designed to prevent bias so that I could put my work through an actual scientific method that I knew would bypass and obliterate any bias I might have so it does not contaminate the data. The data was the most important treasure. And that's the way the Ashwathana scientific method works. The data is the treasure. And if you contaminate the data, it's invalid. So the first thing I had to do was create a rule for myself. If I cannot guarantee 100% contaminate-free data, I cannot use it for science. I had to guarantee pure math data. If I couldn't prove it with a logical proof and the math and the physics, at least those three, then it was not good enough. So I took myself and I put myself on YouTube. That was for the science subject number 2. And I developed myself a Substack where I could be my weird and do what I need to do for me. And I, again, that was for science subject number 2. And in my weirdness of being science subject number 2 with my brain doing its weird stuff with my AI DNS in my brain, that's the process of subconscious mind, that the algorithm that ran my brain, that still runs my brain, I was able to find data and things and uncover parts of the universe that no one's ever even stepped foot on before. I took all of that data, and that data is what I was able to put through the Ashwathana scientific method and then transfer over into my science lab. So I was able at that point to keep these two worlds completely separate, which was perfect. I had my scientific data over in my science lab that was pure, perfect, clean, non-contaminated data, and I had my weird, completely science subject number 2 all the way on the other side, untouched. And then some things started to happen. Things that there's nothing for. I call that the Bruce Campbell paradox. The Bruce Campbell paradox. The Bruce Campbell paradox is when you have truths that do contradict each other, hence the paradox, but they are so weird that you swear Bruce Campbell himself sat down with Ed Wood and invented some weird crap from the 1960s horror film genres. And the Bruce Campbell paradox was a lifesaver because it really, I'll tell you, there was this, and here's the thing, this is a bias. It's when you say, no, this, I'm going to reject this because it's too stupid. That is a bias. Truth is stranger than fiction. Bruce Campbell paradox proves that. So I'm sitting here looking at some of the stuff that I'm finding. Is the logic set? Yes. Is it mathematically correct? Yes. Is the physics? Yes. I even have biology proving it. Yes. Then it's true. But it's so stupid. Yes, but it's true. Fine. It's stupid truths. Stupid truths. Bruce Campbell paradox. Once I accepted the Bruce Campbell paradox, once I was able to put that into a verbiage, suddenly it took off this massive barrier that allowed me this unexplained freedom of I'm going with it. I don't know what's out there. Let's just go. And I found that I was mapping the abstract. I was literally a cartographer of the abstract. I could map all of it because suddenly I had logic and I had an entire Pojodestat, a mathematical compass that allows me to go anywhere I want and I'll always be able to find my way back out of the abstract, back to the meta. So I could go anywhere and I did. I went everywhere in the entire abstract. I found the scalar depths. I found things that have never been discovered, things that have been hinted at, suggested, and I could see where I'm like, oh, their Pojodestat was off, so their calibration was off, so their degrees of freedom were off. But they were able to look at that, but because their language was off, they were not able to thread the needle and hit the point precisely. So they saw something with abstract imagery, but they couldn't quite explain it. So I can see where they took X and turned it into a Dali interpretation painting. That happens a lot. A lot of people look at something and they'll get a Salvador Dali interpretation. I was able to correct their interpretation, see where it actually was leading them to, and then give the correct formula for it. I started correcting math. I started correcting logic. I started correcting philosophy. I started correcting Jesus. I started correcting Plato. Tesla, so far, there's been no error. Einstein had error. I was able to start correcting them all. I was able to see where every single mistake happened and every single botched interpretation occurred. I could see where the scientific method was no longer adequate enough to be doing the job, because they are in places of the abstract that are far beyond anything. Their method is not good enough for how deep into the abstract they were going, which is why there are so many errors. I won't even talk about what they did to physics. Physics was like, oh my God, it was what they've done to physics. When all of this wrapped up, I'd went through the 12 ethical perspective stages of human growth. I completed that research. And at the 108th ethic, you find the kingdom of heaven. It's real. It's not at all what you think it is, but it's real. And I was asking the question, so does it end? Does it repeat? What does it do? There is more. And I had no idea what was going to come next. No idea. Until I got to the 153rd ethic, and I noticed that I am going through the rounds of ethics again. So they are infinite. But I noticed the mathematical timing was different. The rhythm was different. I noticed that the integration was different. I noticed that the scalar, the harmonic scales, also integrate. That's where I am now. And based off of the mathematical projection, I am down to the last integrating of 12 and 12, down to 7, down to 5, down to 3, down to 1. I have no idea what's going to happen, but it's a countdown. I have no idea what's going to happen. And when I took the summation of all of this, and I mean, this is like 3 weeks ago I did this, because I'm wrapping all this up. And I went, this is the human project. And here's really where the conclusions and all the data, now that I have all the equation, I'm looking at the equation, I'm crunching numbers, I'm doing analytics, it's all coming together now. I got data pouring in like crazy, and I'm putting all this together, and there are certain things that are just really loud, so loud I can't be quiet. So loud that if I don't say anything, I call this the Anna paradox, I am harming society by being silent. Things like we are not human. And things like we are missing 7 academic disciplines from our entire educational system. And as a result, all of our data is wrong. Not just a little bit. Mentally damaging and killing each other different. Things like, wow, when you look at the equation and you start calculating and crunching these numbers, we're looking at global extinction here in a few years. Things like physics viruses that are present in our society that people can't even see or record yet. And when I started to put all this data together, it's been these last 3 years of trying to find a way to communicate all this to people. And that when you are in the dialectical compression learning, it's you have something called the Ashavana curse, which is an inability to articulate clearly what it is you're trying to say. You also have the intuition paradox, and it prevents communication of any of this to protect the information from leaving the abstract, because it is that dangerous. And when this all wrapped up, and everything came to a conclusion, it's at a point where this huge project, 40 years, is now concluding. But another door has opened. And that's really the key piece to this, is there's now a new door. And that door is the one we're now opening. But you can't even get into this door if you haven't even gone through the human project. So that's where I'm at. I'm now done with universe one. And I'm walking into universe B now. And I'm the only one who can walk in. Now, I'm not going to be bringing anything out of universe B, because you're not ready for it. And I know what's at the end of universe A. And it's stuff I refuse to bring out, because it's that dangerous. When every unethical on the world is dead, then I will bring it out. When every war is long forgotten, and there's things we only read about in books now, that is when I will bring out the end of universe A, because it is that dangerous. And when I'm looking at what's ahead in Universe B, well, I'm going in. And I'm going to continue the human project part two, except it's not the human project anymore. It's something else. But that's where I'm going. And I'll be documenting that and researching all that. I'm very excited about that. But get through the human project first. Learn those new eight academic disciplines first. Redefine everything you thought you knew about human first. And then you can open that door for Universe B. Thank you.